History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. That's what we've learned, as long as some of us are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then be patient enough to take the time to listen as long-buried memories start to filter back to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 77 years ago this weekend, a small volcanic island in the Pacific, all of 8 square miles, became the scene of one of World War II's most epic battles. We're going to meet one man who was there on Iwo Jima, and before we're done, one who would have been there if he hadn't already been wounded twice. But we'll start out in Sunnyside, Washington, where one of the most impressive veterans memorials I've ever seen takes up an entire city block. I have video of that memorial posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also see some photos of a Marine who just celebrated his 97th birthday. We're going to go back to the early days with Howard Fry, who grew up outside of Ava, Missouri. Where exactly is Ava, Missouri, Howard?
South of Springfield, and that's on the west side of Missouri.
So it's in the Ozarks?
Yeah, now we're getting it. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're growing up, the youngest boy in a family with 6 kids. What do you remember about those growing up years? Were you pretty busy? What were you doing?
Working. We're working all the time. And I had to work to get to go to school. I had to work for $1 a day or $2 a day, and that's it, to get money to go to school.
I mean, these are the years of the Great Depression, and we've heard a lot of stories about how hard it was. Yeah. How young were you when you had to start working to help the family?
Oh, about 6 years old.
What kind of work can you do as a 6-year-old?
Cutting course sprouts, $1 a day.
You picked rocks?
Yeah, I picked the rocks, loaded them in the wagons and stuff, had them, horses and mules and cattle.
Could you see or feel the effects of the Depression? Did that make a difference for your family?
I think so. We had more than some of the other people. That's what it's that way. Cattle and milking eggs and stuff like that. Mom's had to take care of the chickens and stuff, and Dad and we took the outside.
Did you have to milk the cows?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, milk cows one night and one morning.
Does that mean you couldn't play sports in school because you had to be on the farm?
I went to a 2-room school to start. And Dad and his dad gave them land to build a school out. And it was a country school.
So that was your grandfather's land that they built the school on?
Right. And I went through that and started in Ava, a little town there. Yeah, high school up there. Mm-hmm. But we had buses to carry us up there. I had to pay $1 a month to get on the bus to go to school.
So that's why you had to work to earn the money to pay for the bus ride to school?
Right.
So, I mean, I was just looking at your pictures from the Marine Corps. You're the tallest Marine out there. I was just wondering if you ever tried to play basketball or anything.
No. I just didn't want to.
So I've talked to a lot of guys who say they would have liked to play sports, but their family needed them back at home to work on the farm.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I had to work during the summer to get enough money to go to school in the winter, in the fall and spring, milking cows and all that stuff.
Here's a crazy question for you. I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember when you were a boy back home there in Missouri, did you have a dream or an ambition of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I want to be or what I'm going to do?
Yeah, pretty well. I had an eye, something to build to. That's all I needed. I did. I got out when I got into the service. Then that was the end of it. I stayed out.
When did you first start thinking about joining the Marines?
Oh, I had a high school education, and I had to get a deferment to go to that school. And that's where I I just could keep it going. Because I got out of school, then I went into the service.
Was there something you had heard about the Marines, or did you know someone who had been in the Marines?
It's just a circulation of, there's stuff like that, you know, coming in the mail and stuff.
Seeing Leatherneck magazine and knowing what they were doing?
Yeah, Leatherneck magazine.
Yeah. Right. What do you think your expectations were for joining the Marine Corps?
I don't know, just to get out and get on my own. That's all about it. In the Marine Corps, I was on Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, and those.
What was more challenging for you? Work back home on the farm or boot camp for the Marine Corps?
I would say both of them about even. Right. Mostly, I had to work at home continuously. And I don't know. I enjoyed getting into the service.
And I don't think I've met a Marine yet who didn't say, once a Marine, always a Marine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they tell me that it's not just a uniform, it's a mindset and a way of life. How did they indoctrinate you into that? What did they do?
I just don't know. You just follow the commands and everything. It just falls on you. I went to San Diego, Pat Pendleton.
What kinds of things did they have you do?
Everything. We trained on the artillery, and we was out firing a lot, quite a bit, to get your positions located, like drop in on the sites. I was good in math, so they put me on the sites mostly. So there was more than one, because when we're going battle, you got to have two or three behind you. You get knocked off, and the other guy come in. Yeah, I just jumped off a little bit, swam into the beach. I was afraid I couldn't make it, but I did.
You hadn't had a lot of practice swimming like that with a pack on your back?
Yeah, quite a little bit. But I was a little, this was after night. Boy.
And right here, you've got an M1 Garand sitting on your table here. How good a shot were you with one of those?
Oh, I think I had a sharpshooter, I think.
That's what that pin says that you were wearing on your Marine Corps uniform, says sharpshooter. Yeah. Is that because you got some practice growing up in Missouri? Were you shooting animals?
Yeah, I think it helped, because I could handle a rifle, and a lot of guys, they just couldn't handle it.
What did you shoot at back home in Missouri?
Whatever coming up in front of you. No, squirrels and rabbits and pheasants and all that stuff. So I went in when I was 18. By the time I got through school, I was 18.
Yeah, I've heard a few stories about guys who would shoot raccoons or rabbits or possums and get money for them, right?
Yeah, I have had that. Did that. About a dollar, if you're lucky.
How did you feel about the idea of going overseas?
Well, I just went along with it. I knew I had to do it, so I did it.
Was there any thought in your mind that you might not come back?
Oh, probably a little bit, but you had to take care of yourself.
So for a while, you were going to be in an Amtrak unit?
Yeah, I was in that for a while, and quite a bit of stuff. When you went in as artillery, then I was shooting 105s. We were shooting 105s then.
So when you were with the Amtraks, what did you have to do with that?
That's just more or less carrying stuff.
So Guam was your first combat experience?
Yeah, it was my first one.
What do you remember about that? This is July 1944 we're talking about.
I knew I had to get off and go in and get in position.
You're on a 105 millimeter howitzer crew.
Right. At first, when I went over there, I was in, you know, the low class, it's called. And there on the first battle, they went in first because of experience. Then you went in second or third, whenever they needed you. Gotcha. And that was pretty fast. Right.
Had you ever been shot at before?
Oh, yeah, probably a lot of times, but I didn't know it. Artillery.
And so with those 105s, how many people does it take to man one of those?
You got one is pull a lander just for it. One to close it, then pull the lanyard. Then you had the guys feeding ammunition to you.
What about aiming it, directing the fire? What do you have to do?
It's all done in somewhere else, telephoned in.
Right, they telephone you guys, a forward observer or something says, this is where we need it, but how do you make sure that your shell is actually going to go where they want it?
Well, that is up to the main guys. We're just working on command.
Right, and you said you were good at math. So how did that help you with that job?
I had that instruments in here, and every time you go far, you have to take care of that instruments in there. And get your stuff on target, keep it on target all the time, as good as you can. This is a 105, and I was over here. You see that sight right there?
Yep.
That's the sight. And that's one that keeps it in position. The people are running down, they got people out front, ordering back. And then that information comes to us. And then we start firing if we're able to, or stop firing.
So they radio some coordinates to you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what do you have to do on the gun itself to try to hit those coordinates?
Oh, this right here is the gun. This controls here. See this here? This makes it go up and down. This guy's doing this here, and I was on the sights over here. He goes this way, and he goes this way. They just say right 20, two or three, up and down, you know. And I was over here all the time.
What could you see through the sights?
Just enough to get an aim on your target or whatever. Well, you know how that works. Crosshairs, and you have to keep this on till the officer's command comes down for you to change it. Then you change it to what he's asked for.
I don't know if you can answer this question or not in a way that we can all understand, but what does it sound like when that gun goes off?
Just boom. A lot of it, yeah, a lot of it. Especially if you're in a going the faster you go. Four or five or eight beside of you. You're doing the same thing.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of guns lined up firing as fast as you guys can get those shells off. And do you have any protection for your ears?
Well, you could. You have plugs and you go in. But sometimes you get that plug out and you don't have time to put it back in. I was over here, and this guy was loading the ammunition here. Mm-hmm. And the guy back here was handing him the ammunition. So it's just a line coming into your guy.
And when you have a line of artillery like that, the enemy would love to take it out. Did you guys have stuff flying your way?
Well, we were lucky. We never did have too much shrapnel hit us. We just lucky, I guess.
But you do have an injury that you just showed me. You've got a scar.
Them's got rims. They got rims there.
Well, I want an explanation on that. What kind of rims we're talking about here, and what happened to this veteran of the 3rd Marine Division? It's break time. 97-year-old Howard Fry of Sunnyside, Washington is our guest today, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down. 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 77th anniversary of the Battle of Iwo Jima by meeting one of the Marines who was there. 97-year-old Howard Fry of Sunnyside, Washington, originally from Ava, Missouri, he served on a 105mm howitzer crew in the 3rd Marine Division, and he has a scar on his finger that looks pretty grisly. This is from a mishap loading ammunition in one of those big guns.
So this is on your...
My finger around that rim and ram it into that there... That's what I got out of it.
So you got your finger pinched when you were shoving the shell in?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That scar looks like that finger got ripped open pretty good.
It's right there. It's just hanging. Right.
Where were you when that happened?
Guam. That's my medal for the cock. I didn't let them know it. I didn't want no Purple Heart.
I'm just imagining, because I think any guy out there listening has probably hit his finger with a hammer at some point or done something or pinched his finger at a door. Or I'm just looking at your finger.
Oh, yeah.
And you just said that, so that flesh where you have the scar, that there was a cut there and the rest of that finger was just hanging off. So you're bleeding, but blood is not the issue. The pain is what I'm thinking about.
No, I didn't make any difference to me. Just keep it going.
I mean, I would have screamed. If I did that to my finger, I think I would have been screaming in pain.
No, we didn't battle.
Did you bandage it up or anything?
Oh, after a while. Had to get a band-aid around it after a while.
So your time on Guam, were there some things that you went through there that you had to get used to that you'd never experienced before?
Well, you had to do something every day, just about. Uh-huh. Whatever the command and whatever has to be done.
Where did you guys sleep?
On the ground.
You had to dig a foxhole?
Yeah. Yeah, we had foxholes. We had to build a foxhole to keep, especially when you in artillery, you had foxhole more than infantry did. Because it was on the move, and we was move and stop.
Did it get very wet there? Did you have rain fill up your foxhole?
Quite a bit. It rained quite a little bit.
Did you face anything at Guam where you felt like your life was in danger?
Oh, it's always in danger you're out there. It's always in danger.
Because of enemy artillery or bombers or what?
Mostly artillery and snipers, and you're going, and might be a plane come over and drop a bomb or something.
Did you have any contact with your family at all?
Just by letter. Mostly, I received the letters, but I couldn't return them because we was in battle and couldn't return them real quick.
And while you were on Guam, did you have to deal with losing people that you knew? Did you see guys getting killed around you?
Oh, we didn't do it as bad as some of the other guys. It wasn't too bad. Artillery, you're mostly behind the arc. If you get it, you'll get it in a shrapnel from ammunition coming in on you.
Is that something you dealt with?
Oh, yeah, you deal with that all the time.
Was there anything on Guam that you would look back on and say, hey, that was a pretty close call?
Oh, I don't know. You know, we were in a position and we ordered to do it and you didn't get out of there.
But you didn't know what was coming next. And come February of 1945, you ended up at a place that a lot of people had never heard of before. Had you ever heard of Iwo Jima?
No, I don't think so. No, nobody went there. one day we had it pretty well scared, and I walked off a little ways to get more air, and I went around a rock and way down, I don't know, quite a ways, I saw a man, one man down there, and I knew it wasn't ours. I called in ammunition here this far and got him. I just turned around and walked off. So, yeah, you get used to it. I did, anyway.
And the guys that I've talked to that were at Iwo Jima, I've heard a lot of different stories. I guess for you, with the 3rd Marine Division and being in artillery, you wouldn't have been in the first wave of guys going ashore.
No.
What did you see or feel or smell or hear when you went ashore? Can you help us understand what that might have been like?
Nothing smelled good there.
And as you came ashore, could you see some of what had happened before you came ashore?
Yes. Mostly of floating guys or something like that were tore up and laying there and all that. You just walk over and go on.
You were already desensitized to that?
Yeah. It's one or two men go with the ammunition. I mean, he gets on and start firing, and then some more come to back up. So you have backup. If you get shot up, then they'll come in and be another backup for you.
And is anybody shooting at you while you're coming ashore?
You didn't know it. You kept your head down and then take a run when you get in. Artillery and infantry is different. Infantry is ahead of you, trying to get a little place to other people come in. So I can't hardly tell you how it feels. It's just numb. You do what you're supposed to.
And, you know, there's a lot of stories about how they thought they could make pretty quick work of Iwo, that it wouldn't take long to secure the island. Do you remember hearing anything?
I don't know. We was hoping. That's about all I can tell you. We was just hoping.
But did you know how many tunnels they had there?
No, we didn't know that. See, we was out in the field, and some of them was back there, and they're going through them tunnels and stuff, and we're out in the field.
Was that a little disorienting, not to know where the enemy was all the time?
Well, I'm in artillery, you see. The infantry is ahead of me. They call it a firing, and we do what they want you to hit, so they can go for some more push. Most of the way they did is the morning, they would make a push, but they want some artillery ahead of them, and then pull in and come in and take them.
So there's not a whole lot of margin for error with that, is there?
No, there isn't. No, you got men ahead of you, and they're all around you, and you better stay with you what they tell you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering if there was a feeling of responsibility with that, because if your math is a little off, you might kill your own guys.
Well, it might have been, but I don't think I felt that way. I felt like I knew that they was giving me coordinates and everything. They had people up front calling them coordinates in, and maybe one of our might get off a little bit and go over and kill one or two. You never know. You never know what you're doing up there.
What was the biggest difference between what you experienced at Guam and what you experienced at Iwo Jima?
I think it was maybe a little more hotter in Iwo Jima than it was down there in Guam.
And, you know, for most people, if you say Iwo Jima, there's one particular image that comes to mind, and maybe the most famous photograph of all time that was taken atop Mount Suribachi with the flag going up. Did you see at some point the flag flying on top of Mount Suribachi?
Oh, yes. Right. Right. Yeah, we did. You know, now we got it. See? Something like that. Really something. It wouldn't be there 1 minute. The next minute it'd be there. And, you know, feel a lot better.
Well, I'm sure you've seen that photo a few more times since then. And you've seen the statue and all of that. I'm just wondering what you think about when you see that photograph. What does it mean to you?
I know I wouldn't want to go back again. You have so many different feelings. Most of the general, you're always trying to stay alive.
When I asked you about close calls on Guam, what about on Iwo Jima? Were there some close calls?
They were bad, too. See, the main push was a lot harder than the second push. So we was on the second push, or whatever you want to call it. They had that part secured to get enough ammunition and to get the artillery in, start firing, you see. To the instrument, I say, is the best. I mean, the worst. It's all bad. But the infantry is bad because they got to go in and kill.
Well, I don't want to take too big of a leap here, but it kind of sounds like you're saying maybe being in the artillery saved your life?
You never know. I think so. Probably so.
I'm just thinking about the timing of everything, and as you just said, the big push was before, you know, they created room for you guys to come ashore and do the artillery job. Were you still there on the island when they had those cemeteries there with all the white crosses?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's bad. Yeah.
You've got a souvenir right under your hand here that is a knit scarf with some Japanese characters on it. What's the story behind that? Where did that come from?
It's on Iwo Jima, or where's that? Where it got it?
Was it on the body of a Japanese soldier?
Yeah. Some of that.
What was the most challenging aspect of what you did?
Now you ask me to. I had a lot of them. I don't know. I enjoyed it and I didn't enjoy it. But I had to do it and I did it. So I don't know.
What was the part that you enjoyed?
I'm coming home. Yeah, yeah. You go in there and do your job, then come in and start training again to go to another guy.
What were the things that you did not enjoy?
Killing. Yeah. I hated it.
You were a very young man. In fact, your birthday's in February.
Yeah.
So when you were at Iwo Jima, you had just turned 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at dead Americans and dead Japanese?
Japanese, they were up in, at that time, they was up in Motom, underground. You could hear them digging. You could hear them digging, trying to get out.
I'm just wondering what it's like, because, I mean, we know now how long it lasted, but at the time, you don't know. No one's telling you, hey, next week it's over.
Sometime we're going to get out of here, maybe.
So when you're in one of those foxholes at night trying to sleep, what kind of stuff do you think about?
Probably home. Probably. We got down to where we had a little time. I went for a walk from the artillery. I just took off. Started to the airport. It was just a little bit away from us. I went over there and got started again. And it got pretty hot. And I said, ah, damn, I better get back. So I went about and got back and got in the foxhole again, so.
And when you say it got pretty hot, you're not talking about the temperature?
No.
So you're just off walking by yourself and there's stuff flying through the air?
Yeah, so I just went back.
You know, there's something else you have on the table here. You've got an M1 and you've got some Japanese money and this scarf that came from one of the Japanese soldiers. And then you've got a little tiny Bible over there, too.
Yeah. I carried it all the time.
What did that mean to you?
Well, I hoped it helped me.
It's not like you can read it in a foxhole at night, right?
No, you could. You couldn't read it anywhere. It's there.
Was there ever any concern about the Japanese coming into your area at night?
Oh, yes, and they did. Well, all I know is that I do what they tell me to. I was in there to try to get home.
I said that earlier, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Good outfit. One of the best, I think.
One of the best. We can say that about Howard Fry as well. And for a little additional perspective, let's hear from Howard's daughter, Pam. Pam, growing up, did you know your dad had been in the Marines?
You know, we were so young, you know, and it was just part of life. I mean, it was what happened. His uniform was there. It was always in the trunk. You know, we'd get it out and look at it. But he didn't talk much about it. Mostly what I knew about the war was what I learned in school. And then as we got older, you know, we'd ask questions and looked at all of his memorabilia and stuff. But, you know, I knew he'd served and I was proud of that. And I think it made him a really strong person. He still is. That's what keeps him going. He's just so determined. You know, just, he's a fighter all the way. So, you know, he was a good dad.
You know, Iwo Jima has been as publicized as pretty much any battle in World War II. And like we talked about with him, that image of the flag atop Mount Suribachi is so iconic. I'm sure you've read and heard and seen a lot of things about Iwo Jima over the years. Is it hard to imagine?
I cannot fathom being 18 years old and going into a war like that, especially coming from the hills of Missouri, where you're just such a young, impressionable youth, I guess, and taking off on a bus, having never been on a bus, and going clear across the country and unloading on in a state that you've never been in, and then doing all the things that you do and fighting and all of that is just, I can't imagine an 18-year-old or 19-year-old doing that now. I can't.
You know, I don't want to be melodramatic or cliche or anything, but when you know how many Marines died to take Iwo Jima and you know your dad was there, does that impact the way you see your own existence?
Oh, definitely. You know, I feel very fortunate that he survived because I wouldn't be here. My kids wouldn't be here. You know, my grandchildren wouldn't be here. I'm just glad that he took the job that he had and wasn't in the, you know, the infantry or in the Amtrak, and that, you know, he did what he did. And it's, you see the stories and you see the clips from the news, and it's just, oh, it's just crazy what they went through.
And here in Sunnyside, you directed me to a real impressive memorial that you have in downtown. It takes up an entire block, and I think you said it's going to be the biggest by weight memorial in the state?
Right, by weight. Due to the size and the weight of the granite blocks, I think it's really special. It's just beautiful what they've done. And the gentleman that is leading that is a classmate of mine, and he was in the Vietnam War. He has just, I mean, it's basically his life. He lives and loves that, you know, what he does. And it's, I think a lot of people are very proud that that's in Sunnyside.
Your dad and his generation of service people, what do they represent to you?
You know, I think they made the United States what it is, what it should be. I mean, when they were over fighting, then the women and the men and the people still here were doing things they never dreamed that they would be doing, put in a position, having to go on food stamps and not being able to buy their nylons and, you know, just the different things that people had to do to survive, to give up. When they'd already given up a whole lot and didn't have much because of the Depression. And then here they were faced with working in plants when women were typically home, you know, taking care of the kids. And there they were putting airplanes together. So, you know, it's an amazing generation, and there's not very many of them left.
And that's exactly why we do this show, to capture those stories while they're still here to tell them. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, memories from a twice-wounded Marine who passed away this week at 97. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton. With experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Thanks again to Howard Fry and his daughter Pam in Sunnyside, Washington. That Veterans Memorial there, it's really worth checking out. So if you're ever through the southeast part of that beautiful state, take a look in Sunnyside. And for the rest of our time today, I want you to hear some of the story of an amazing Marine we lost this week at the age of 97. Francis O'Brien was the father of 14 and a post-war college football star at Dartmouth with nine fingers. But to experience all of that, he had to survive being wounded twice in the Pacific with the 4th Marine Division.
We're going to the Marshall Islands at a place called Kwajalein, which was the largest island enclosed portion of the lagoon in the Pacific Ocean. One end of the lagoon was Kwajalein. At the other end of the island was a place called Roy and Namur. And it was R-O-I for Roy and Namur, N-A-M-U-R. And we were going to land on the Namur. And our lieutenant said, you know, tomorrow we're going to land on the Namur. There are about 2,500 Japanese there. We're going to land with about 2,500 men. And in 24 hours, it is either ours or we're all dead. And that was the pep talk.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
Very encouraging. So we're supposed to land by LVTs, which are landing vehicle tractors. They had problems before with Tarawa, where the landing boats got hung up on a reef. The tide had changed and whatever else had happened, and they couldn't get in. The men had to wade ashore about a couple hundred yards offshore, had to wade to get on the island.
And a lot of them didn't get on the island. They got mowed down trying to get there.
A lot didn't get there. And so now we're going to bypass that action. We're going to go in the back way into the lagoon. And we'll have earlier guys from the 25th Marines going. We were the 24th. From the 25th Marines going to set up artillery on these little islets to kind of support us as we came in the back way. Well, you're aboard the USTs and we had to put camouflage paint on and all that business, and we did. Then we got aboard the LVTs. Now we were supposed to leave at 10 o'clock. But it takes time to get LVTs off. Then once they're lined up, then the commanders go, and you go towards the island. That way, everybody is on the island pretty much at the same time. So we got on the island, and we had a young guy from Champaign, Illinois, who was bet by some hot shot in his class that he could get in the Marine Corps and Frank couldn't. Frank was so naive, he said, I bet him. He said, I got in the Marine Corps, and he didn't, plus the fact I didn't get the $50. And that's the kind of gullibility. I mean, and a super smart kid. I think they claim he had the highest IQ in the division. But anyway, we land. Someone said, where's Frank? I said, I don't know. He's probably behind somewhere. I said, I'll go back and check. And I went back to check. And Frank was in a hole in his helmet. He was dead. And there he was sitting there. He's the first casualty that I saw. And, you know, that leaves the mark on you that, well, you know, when someone says, sniper, be awake, be alert, there's probably somebody who, you know, doing something. So we went through the moor. We got down through a clearing. And I was a bazooka man. And firing these rockets. I had never fired a rocket before because you don't expend the ammunition and all that. You go through the dry runs. So the officer said there was a house and a spotlight, a searchlight. And he said, see if you can hit the house. You know, see if you can. So I aimed and hit the house and blew it up. And when that happens, this is different now than being trained. Now see what you can do when you do it. That kind of gives us some enthusiasm. But now you become almost like a showboat. Boy, I'm glad I can hit that house. And then he said, there was a Japanese sitting up on top of a revetment. He said, O'Brien, you hit the Japanese and I'll kiss your eyes. And I thought that was an interesting challenge. So I aimed And what happens with the Zucca tube, it's just a pipe. As it gets hot from the propellant in the rocket, you're almost aiming at the ground because it'll take off on you. I was aiming at the ground and apparently hit the Japanese, and he's on my back, banging on my shoulder, just like he scored a touchdown. Hooray, around his jeez. So now we thought we were going to take over the island. So Al Prusik, the officer, and Norrie Savage, just a guy like I was, the three of us take off to the revetment. And as we got there, our machine gunners opened fire on the revetment. At the same time, the Japanese in the revetment opened fire. So now we're on our back watching all these tracer bullets go by, because between each tracer there's probably three or four regular bullets, and we watched that for about a half an hour. It was thrilling, it was neat, it was something we hadn't done before. Now they ceased firing. So I got up first and I led the bunch out, and I'm running down, and I kind of made a half turn to my left. And as I did, I felt like I got hit in the epiglottis of your body, and I kind of lost my breath. I kept running. Got down into the hole, and my little finger on my left hand was just hanging off, just like a chicken wing had been broken. It wasn't bleeding, it wasn't hurting, but it looked kind of strange. Prusik, the officer, came in, and I said, I've been hit. He said, yeah, you haven't been. I said, look at that finger. Hey, damn if you haven't. So for the first time, I had seen a first aid packet open up. And all a first aid packet was a piece of Kotex about 4 or 5 inches long, with about 72 yards of cotton bandage, and miserable. You try putting that on a finger that's hanging out, and it doesn't do much. Now, I just casually put my hand up under my dungaree jacket, and man, it was a warm hole, and I thought, wow, what's that? And at that time, it's amazing. I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. And Prusik wanted to give me some water. And I remember an old movie where Edward G. Robinson, I think it was, got raked by a machine gun. He had taken a drink of water and he was trying to plug up the holes with his fingers as the water was coming out. And I said, I don't want water. You know, let me alone. About that time, a very good friend of mine, D.B. Kellenberger, came to the top of the hole and looked down at me. We had no communication. We had no phones. We had no cell phone. We had nothing. So DB took his jacket off. I can still see him now. Took his helmet off. And we had been aboard ship for quite a while, so we were tan. We looked like we were Japanese, I suppose. And DB went running back to get some help for me. And while doing that, one of our guys, friendly fire, shot, and he later on died.
Oh.
And here was a guy who was, DB was at Pearl Harbor on December the 7th, and he was up all day. Then he got assigned to guard duty that night, and while on guard duty, fell asleep and got caught. I think he got a general court-martial. They're going to put him in the brig for forever, I suppose. And then later on, they cleaned the brig out and sent DB to the 4th Marine Division. And DB's brag to fame was he was the oldest private in the Marine Corps, which he couldn't be promoted, and there he was. And yet DB was, I mean, just a delightful guy. He used to impersonate W.C. Fields. He never wore a belt on his dungarees. He used to tie it up with a shoestring. Why, I don't know. And we used to play cards aboard the ship. And we always won. I don't know how we did that, but we did. Here he was. He dies going to get help for me. You know, a guy that he had just met. So, I mean, you know, it's that kind of stuff that makes you wonder, you know, what a war is all about.
So you're 20 years old. You're hit in the chest and your fingers hanging off. And this was your first experience in combat, period.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's not very encouraging. Take me from there. How did you deal with that situation?
Well, you know, in reading about our division was one of the probably youngest divisions in the Marine Corps. We went through 4 major battles, which means 4 major landings. Wound up with probably, I guess, 20% were casualties. You know, you've got about 20,000 guys in the division, but a lot of them are mechanics or paper, they're cooks or other things. They're not combat men. They're not out in the field, but out there shooting and being shot at.
That percentage was a lot different for the guys who were doing what you were doing.
I mean, and that kind of campers, which way you're trying to talk.
How much pain were you in?
It's interesting. I had no pain.
Huh.
I had no pain. they sent some guys up as stretcher bearers. And these were usually band men or crooks or something. And they came up, they didn't have a stretcher, so he had to improvise a stretcher. Well, then they couldn't lift me.
You were one of the bigger guys, huh?
So they couldn't lift me, so they dragged me through all these holes over to the beach. And again, honestly, nothing hurt.
Were you scared?
I wasn't bleeding, and I was still conscious. I knew what was going on. And we got down to the evacuation center. I remember the guy saying, "Where's the hospital ship?" Well, there were about 9 transports out there. It's out there. We went out, we'd bump into a ship, and it's just a hospital ship. It's like, "No, try T-boats over." And we kept going. Finally, we got to a hospital ship. They lowered this thing down and hooked up my stretcher and picked me up and put me aboard the ship. And the first thing they did was take your valuables. And I think I had a New Testament and something else in the pocket, and they put that on my chest. Well, then they took all my clothes off and put my valuables on my chest, took me to the mess room where the cooks had been and all that business, and laid me on the table. And then they started asking, "How did it happen?" "How do I know how it happened? Some guy shot me." "Well, where did it go?" I said, "I have no idea." So they rolled me over and finally found there was a hole about the size of a little finger just above my hip. That was the entry. It came out by my navel. Uh-huh. And left about a 4x4 hole. Ooh. And there it was. And
how many vital organs did that thing
hit? Yeah, I mean, it didn't hit anything. It didn't hit a thing.
Isn't that miraculous?
It is a miracle. Yeah, I mean, and I remember one of the doctors who had been at Mayo Clinic, he said, "O'Brien, you're in such good shape. The bullet took the course of least resistance. I'd give you a break." You know?
How long did it take you to recover before you went back?
I went back in the end of May, and the wounds happened on the 2nd or 3rd of February.
So that's 3 months. Long,
but I was ambulatory.
Yeah.
I was walking.
During that time, were you ever scared or concerned that you weren't going to make it? Or that
I wasn't scared of that, but you know where proud flesh is?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, in the wound, right from the center of it, proud flesh started developing. And I was puffing up, and he had the illusions. Maybe the shell is still in there, and it hasn't gone off yet.
That would get your attention, sure.
Yeah, now, you know, and I kept watching this thing. And finally, a doctor came in. He was the guy from Mayo Clinic. She grabbed a pair of clippers and clipped off the proud flesh, and that was it. It didn't hurt, and of course, it disappeared. It didn't come back.
What about your finger?
And the finger was, I guess I finally, you know, I could move it. And, of course, that gives you something else you can do. You can move the finger. And I don't know how many stitches they had in there. But I remember when they cut it off, my first question was, "This won't put me out of the Marine Corps, will it?" The doctors assured me it wouldn't.
Well, you say that pretty matter of fact, but that's a big deal for someone really to come to grips with the fact that, hey, I had 10 and now I've got 9. Yeah.
Well, I mean, when I was teaching, I used to sometimes do this. And the kids wouldn't know what was going on, or I do this, and they wouldn't know what was going on.
Make your visible finger disappear into your nostril or your ear.
And don't get excited until you see something coming out this year.
Let me read something to you here. It's a Bronze Star citation, and it says, "For heroic achievement in action against the enemy while serving with the Marine Rifle Company on Saipan, Marianas Islands, from 15 June to 9 July 1944, when his squad leader was wounded early in the operation, Corporal O'Brien took over the squad and furnished his men with an excellent example of leadership. On 22 June 1944, Corporal O'Brien carried a wounded Marine on his back for some 200 yards under hostile machine gun and mortar fire when his platoon dropped back to a defensive line for the night. On 28 June 1944, he carried a wounded Marine from a position exposed to hostile machine gun and mortar fire some 200 yards to an area where he could be evacuated. His heroic actions were a source of inspiration to those about him and were in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service."
And, you know, and to be perfectly honest with you, you're scared and you want to get the hell out of there. And you'd pick up the Empire State Building and carry it if you had to.
But it says the rest of your guys in that first one on the 22nd, that the rest of your platoon had dropped back to a defensive line for the night, and you're running back out there where they're firing at you to try to rescue somebody.
Well, I mean, you know, and you don't know how you do it. You have no idea. And if you saw a movie of it, you wouldn't believe it. But you're scared. I mean, everybody's scared. I didn't see John Wayne out there at all. He can do all he wants in the movie, Iwo Jima, but hey, baby, when you're there, you're scared. I guess I was scared. You get done, and then the other thing that happens is that people observe you. Guys had to write down stuff. Whether they had illusions, I have no idea. But if it was machine gun fire and mortar fire, I don't remember that.
You just remember one of your buddies was down?
I remember getting the hell out of there. And that was what I did. And
tell me how you got wounded again.
On Tinian was a different story. I'd fired the bazooka stuff and all that stuff, and we thought we had it under control. We probably thought the three of us, were going to take over the whole island. Because it was only a 24-hour operation. I was wounded again, but I have no idea what it was. No idea.
But that finished you off, as far as the Marine Corps was concerned.
Well, as far as the Marine Corps was concerned, and I'll never forget when Archie Vandegrift Jr., the battalion commander, who was the son of the commandant, called me and said, "O'Brien, you're going home." I said, "You're crazy. I'm back on active duty. I'm experienced. You won't have to train anybody else." And he said, "I have a letter here from Archie Vandegrift, the commandant. This is what my dad says. This is what you're going to do." So they sent me back.
You didn't want to go home.
No, I mean, you're in, I don't want to say you're enjoying it, but it's part of your whole routine now.
So if you hadn't have gone home, you probably would have been at Iwo Jima?
Yeah. And no doubt, if I'd have been at Iwo Jima, I'd have been killed.
No doubt.
Because the guy who took my place was Chester Darnell, who was about maybe 5'6 or so, and frail kind of a guy. He was in the foxhole, and naval gunfire, short round, phosphor shell, landed in a hole with him, and very severely burned him and all that stuff. And I was with him before he died and went to see him in the hospital down in Houston. Chester had gone back to school, was now a lawyer and all this stuff, but had it been me in that hole, being much bigger than he, it'd have been it. So, I mean, and it's all by whatever the twist of God is. I mean, it's whatever's in store for you.
Well, and that's my next question, because you have 14 children, and yep. You've got more grandchildren and great-grandchildren than you can count.
Yep.
And none of them would have ever been born if you didn't come home.
Yeah, but my wife would have never had all the experiences that she had either.
That sense of humor is something his family will miss the most about Francis O'Brien, a spirited Purple Heart Marine who passed away this week at the age of 97. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also see photos and video with Howard Fry, who we met for the first time this week. That's all the time we have, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.